Money FM 89.3, best of the evening runway. Eurowatch.
Money FM 89.3. It is the evening runway. I'm Elliot Danka. We're going to take a look at some headlines from the European region. We've got Russia, of course, still reeling from Friday's attack by gunmen. They killed scores of people before setting fire to the Krakow City Concert Hall outside Moscow. The attack, one of the worst that the country has seen in over a decade. And of course, that assault came less than a week after President Vladimir Putin claimed a landslide victory in the pro forma election. The Kremlin presented as an endorsement of Putin's war in Ukraine. Now, the Islamic State group has said four of its members carried out the attack, yet Russian officials, as well as state media, have largely ignored any Islamic State link, focusing almost exclusively on a possible Ukrainian connection. We'll try and figure out what the President Vladimir Putin will do next and what it means for that conflict with Ukraine. On the line with me is Dr. Samir Puri, who is Associate Fellow UK in the World Programme at Chatham House. Dr. Samir, how are you?
I'm very well. Looking forward to the long weekend. But good to speak to you.
Yeah, good to speak to you too, sir. Let's take a look at this incident. Really unfortunate. Estimated that more than 130 people were killed. Scores more injured, of course, at that Krakow City Hall concert venue last Friday. The Islamic State claiming responsibility. Was there a particular reason, or is there a particular reason, that Russia has found itself in the sights of the Islamic State terror group?
Yeah, so Russia has a long history of suffering terrorism from groups, different kinds of groups that have some sort of link to Islamist ideologies. And slightly older listeners, or those with a longer memory, will remember 20-plus years ago, Russia's war in Chechnya and the terrorism that resulted from that conflict. And in the sort of intervening two decades, to simplify things, quite a number of Russian citizens from Chechnya, from other parts of the North Caucasus, did travel to other parts of the world to join ISIS in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, elsewhere. So all of that comes down to the obvious point, which is Russia has experienced terrorism before. There was a Beslan school siege, the Moscow Opera Hall siege from 20 years ago, attacks on the Moscow metro. But the reason this attack is a hugely tragic incident for Russia is also striking, is it's the first big terrorist attack on Russian soil for a very long time. So this is something that Putin would have said that he has solved as a problem for Russians to protect them against this kind of terrorism. So it's, as well as a huge human loss, it's also a big stain on the Russian state's record to be able to say it can defend its citizens against this kind of terrorism.
Questions definitely that should be asked. Although Moscow has insinuated, without evidence I might add, that the perpetrators plan to flee to Ukraine. Okay, where is the thought process or agenda, or is this trying to spin the situation so that it fuels their conflict with Ukraine?
Yes, you've nailed it exactly that. And one of the hallmarks of the aftermath of a terrorist attack is the confusion around attribution, the sorts of terrorist attacks where there's a shadowy network, where the people who are perpetrating the attack, and of course they're all captured alive in this particular instance, in Tajikistan, as his reporting has conveyed. It's still very hard to pin down who asked them to conduct the attack, who gave them the money, who facilitated them with weapons. And all of that confusion creates quite a lot of latitude to reinterpret the sequence of events in a way that serves a government's need. And needless to say, in the Russians' context, it serves their needs in the Kremlin to point out this has a link to Ukraine, even if they're not. Sometimes you hear the Russians say, well, it was directly involved, yeah, the Ukrainians and Western governments. But I think even if they just point to the fact that there was a geographic, they were trying to flee to Ukraine, geographically speaking, then that's enough, like, in the minds of Russians to make a link between this attack, this atrocity, and what's happening in Ukraine.
Doctor, I just want to pick up on the words you use there. It serves their needs to point this in this direction. How then, because of this, do you see this conflict potentially going? Does it give it a second, or should I say a third win as far as Russia's forces are concerned?
Yeah. At a very general level, there is, even if there's a poor connection or no connection between a terrorist attack that a country suffers at home and its military operations abroad, it generally within the population creates a sense of hurt, creates a desire for vengeance. It may engender some patriotism. It might even be a motivation for some people to want to join the Russian military. Mm. And Russia is not alone in that. I'm not making any moral link whatsoever, but it's a well-known argument that there was no connection between Iraq and 9/11. Yeah. But nonetheless, for many Americans, the fact that these events happened in the same space of time,
yeah,
and there was some sort of sense of hurt and vengeance that connected them all. This is 20 plus years ago.
Yeah.
That's just, I think, the way a country might end up feeling, especially if it's involved in military operations and invasions abroad as well.
Yeah. Human emotions can be a tool or a very dangerous thing to play with, Doctor. But I guess I do want to focus how this happened just days or a week after President Vladimir Putin began his fifth term of office. I want to talk about the incident, and this kind of comes back to your very first question, of those questions on security within Russia. You watch in the movies anything that's going to happen in Russia, it's so tight. How could you possibly infiltrate? Does this show cracks then?
Yeah, the point about the election is clear. I mean, no one expected Putin to lose. It was more or less a coronation rather than an election.
Yeah.
And given that Russia has so many enemies now around the world, not only Ukraine, but those who are backing Ukraine and consider Russia's invasion to be morally reprehensible,
Yeah. Anything
that could embarrass Putin around the time of the election and in its immediate aftermath to ruin that sense of coronation, people would be very pleased. The Ukraine, of course, conducted its own separate military operations elsewhere to try to prove that point. So I think there's certainly the timing. It feels like it's too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence. That why now? Why sponsor these tragic individuals to conduct this terrorist attack other than to ruin the party domestically in Russia? Because don't forget, last point on this, you know, Russia could potentially insulate some of its people from the events happening next door in Ukraine.
Yeah.
By presenting the issue in a very particular way in the media. And, you know, this actually brings it home to maybe some people who otherwise are totally uninvolved in the war in Ukraine, that obviously for one horrible night, one part of Moscow, the outskirts has been itself turned into a war zone.
Yeah, yeah. And just quick closing thoughts on this particular issue. How do you think Vladimir Putin has handled the situation?
So given his previous career prior to politics,
yep,
he is
KGB.
I suppose uniquely well placed to engage with his own intelligence services and his police services as they conduct their investigation, which they will have to do. So the identities of the attackers and how they're linked to external forces. So I would assume that once the evidence picture starts to come together, Putin would want to use that in whatever ways he wants. But it's hard to really answer that question directly, because there's clearly going to be a tightening of Russia's domestic security. But the one thing that hasn't happened is any disruption to Russia's war effort in Ukraine next door. They've still been pummeling Ukraine with their long-range missiles and heavy aerial bombardments of some of Ukraine's major cities. So if anyone, even if they were just looking at these two events and thought that this terrorist attack might distract Russia, draw its security forces away from the war in Ukraine, I think Russia and Putin will be keen to prove the Russian state that they can do both at the same time. You know, clamp down on Islamist-inspired terrorism at home and continue their so-called special military operation next door in Ukraine.
Oh, good points there. All right, Doctor, let's head over to the United Kingdom. They have accused Beijing-backed groups of targeting democratic institutions and parliamentarians in two cyber campaigns. It's unveiled sanctions. It's summoned China's ambassador. The Chinese embassy in Britain has hit back, calling the claim completely unfounded, accusing London of malicious slander. Okay, let's wind it back a little bit. The UK accusing Beijing of espionage attacks. I mean, how much evidence do they actually have? Should we believe the entirety of this?
Probably yes. The UK state is not one to maybe make a claim like this unless they felt they had the evidence to do so. And, I mean, obviously we can't evaluate that evidence here on air, but I think the general theme is that this is going to become more of the norm in politics, because how do you insulate your political processes from outside interference, outside meddling? These things have changed beyond all technological recognition in the space of 10 or 15 years. I mean, that's a clearly obvious point. So I think the UK, like many other advanced countries are looking at the cutting edge of how their political systems and their politicians can be influenced in a malign way from outside, and they're trying to be quicker off the mark in responding when they gather the evidence to point this out. I think the specifics of this one, and there was a parliamentarian called Oliver Dowden and a few others who were sort of quite prominent in how this is reported in the British press, but I think the specifics of this now comes down to, again, this issue of evidence, how quickly the British state can accumulate evidence around how this meddling happened and respond quickly. But it's like the proverbial game of whack-a-mole, isn't it? You're never going to solve the problem. And I think this is just part of the reality of modern defense of a country's integrity of its political systems. You just have to continually be aware of what's happening, continually ready to call out and attempt to influence negatively when you find the evidence.
Doctor, pardon my creative mind, what are the odds or correlation between this particular, I mean, espionage is not new, but right now, emphasis on cyber espionage. Britain is expected to hold a general election in the coming months, and there have been attacks of the cyber kind, 2021, 2022, and now there's this accusation. Am I overly creative here?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a continuous thing. But probably the watershed is, not to go down this rabbit hole, is probably the 2016 US election.
That's the one where
I think a lot of countries looked, because that's the biggest show in town, the US election.
Yes.
A lot of countries looked at the allegations, in that case, of Russian electoral manipulation. And to the extent they were founded or not, it just changes the game, doesn't it, in terms of how seriously you take this.
All right. Dr. Samir, let's head over to Hungary, where protests have erupted as a leaked recording stoked a continuing scandal that has rocked the government. The episode, of course, extends the pressure on Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's populist government. Critics, of course, have accused of systemic corruption. This tape has come from a former government insider, if I'm not wrong, turned a critic. What can you tell us about it?
Well, on the specifics, I'm very far away from Hungary, but I can't tell you too much. But I think in the general point, Viktor Orbán has, he bestrides the politics of that country like a colossus. His views are very, very particular. There's not really much room for compromise. And, Hungary is still part of the EU. It's still ostensibly a democracy, even though it's Orbán has, effectively monopolized politics there for so many years. So then, similar to other countries where this sort of thing has happened, like Turkey, there's a question as to what does the political opposition actually, what can they do? And they can do things by trying to potentially embarrass the incumbent and try to find cracks in the system. So I think that it's all part of that. But past precedent suggests that Orbán will be able to ride this out somehow. But I suppose the final observation on this is he does poll very highly in opinion surveys in Hungary. He has done in the past. The real question will be whether this at all dents wider public perceptions of him and more people start to become disenchanted with his claim to leadership in Hungary.
Right. I appreciate you setting all that up as far as the context is concerned, because you've, of course, got European parliamentary elections in June. We've talked about how, this really shouldn't affect Viktor Orbán that much. What about the fact that this critic, Peter Magyar, is there any possibility that he's planning to establish his own political party, perhaps?
Yeah, and I don't know the specifics about him too much, but that's one possibility. I just think that Hungary and Orbán have been able to resist all the criticisms that have come from Brussels quite stridently, quite impressively, I have to say, given that Hungary is not a big country and it has been partly dependent on EU funding. So I think there's also, this is the sort of thing that will play very well in Brussels, where there's obviously enormous numbers of critics of Orbán, and they would be very pleased to see any evidence that shows any sort of wrongdoing around his government that could add further pressure, potentially external pressure, on his claim to monopolizing Hungarian politics.
Quite a few things to watch out for there. We've been speaking with Dr. Samir Puri, who is Associate Fellow, UK in the World Programme at Chatham House. Dr. Samir, appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Good to speak to you.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio, at the App Store and Google Play.